Thank you, Tessa. And I too would like to welcome you all on behalf of the Family Justice Council. This is, I think, the sixth annual debate that we have organized. They've all been very well attended. They've all addressed topical issues for family justice. And this is clearly a worthy successor to those that have gone before. Tessa has said that the speakers are eminent, as indeed they are. But having seen the delegate list of all you who are attending, I see what an enormous expertise there is gathered in the room here today. Now, the format is straightforward. We have 1 hour for the debate, followed by 1 hour for discussion. And it follows that each speaker gets something approaching 15 minutes. Now, Dr. Karen Broadhurst is going to propose the motion. Tina Wilson will then oppose the motion. Anna Wright will then come in for the motion. And Natasha Watson has the last word. And... I have been provided with biographies for each of the speakers, and I would take 15 of our 60 allotted minutes were I to read these out to you. But suffice it to say that Karen is senior lecturer in social work at Lancaster University. Tina Wilson is County Manager for Safeguarding Children in Suffolk. Anna Wright is Honorary Research Fellow at University College London. She has a wealth of experience in local government employment. And Natasha Watson is co-chair of the Sussex Family Justice Board and managing principal lawyer for the local city council. So you can see that the debaters know what they're talking about. So with that, I will ask Karen whether she would propose the motion.
I've got some slides. Being an academic, I'm psychologically dependent on slides. So I'm going to come over here and hope this works, Alex. Just to set up what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so yes, as Lord Justice Thorpe says, I'm proposing the motion. And my interest in women who've been subject to repeat compulsory removals of children stems from a long-standing engagement practice near research with a number of local authorities in which myself and my colleague Claire, who's sat here on the front row in a very becoming fuchsia dress, we managed to get out of doing the talk. We've done a lot of research with local authorities, and obviously the issue of repeat removals keeps coming up. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, on humanitarian grounds alone, it's very difficult not to be bothered by these stories. So alongside a number of other research projects that we're running with DfE and CAFCAS, we decided to do a bit of pilot work and have managed to profile 30 birth mothers. So to set the scene, I mean, my view is in supporting the motion, there's two questions that need to be addressed. I think anecdotally, we all know that these mothers are vulnerable, but we need some empirical evidence, which is what Claire and I have set out to do. I know also FDAC, Judith Harwin, Mike Shaw, Sophie and colleagues, and also colleagues from Suffolk, and Reading have also produced data. So I mean, we have an aspiration that we'll put this data together, produce something convincing for government. But I'm going to just set the scene by saying, OK, are these women vulnerable? And part two, I think, in supporting the motion is to say, are these women falling through service cracks? So is the system failing? So first, I'm going to run through some preliminary findings from this data. In relation to broad questions of vulnerability. And then second, I'm going to just run through a short case study that illustrates the way in which a young care leaver falls through the gaps and has these multiple pregnancies. Okay, so I'm going to try and stick to time as well. So three local authority sites, work's ongoing. Our criteria was to, within the period 2008 to 2012, to identify a sample of women who had had a further pregnancy previous to that. They've either had a single or multiple pregnancies, and they've had compulsory removal of those children, mostly through adoption, some special guardianship. So we've got 30 birth mothers with surprisingly 116 infants. And as Tina will tell you later, it's quite a piece of parallel work that we haven't communicated about until this point. You've also had 30 birth mothers with, I think, 116 children. So it does show that the volume of children that these mothers can have, and you know, how tragic that is. What we've tried to do is to sort of map their life stories in a way. So just to really simplify that, what you can see here is, I don't think any of this will be new to you, but just providing the empirical evidence that this is about, you know, a pattern that starts very young in motherhood. So we've got our youngest mother in the sample, 15, when she starts on this cycle. And all the mothers were under 25 at first removal. And having a daughter myself who's 20, that seems incredibly young and vulnerable to be starting out on a pattern of repeat removals. Staggeringly, within our sample of 30 mothers, we've also got 35% who are pregnant again before legal proceedings have concluded. Again, I think that'll be a familiar scenario to you. What we've begun to do is try to map these pregnancies. And I think one of the things that's quite interesting that's come out of this so far is that these pregnancies, some women seem to be having a pattern of just having another baby every couple of years, sometimes even within 2 years or 3 years, whereas other women do actually seem to be having a space between pregnancies, but still failing again, perhaps when they think, I've met a new partner, I'm going to try again here. So it would suggest that one of the things we need to look at is something around planning, that some women are perhaps not planning, their lives are pretty much out of control, whereas other women are actually taking some control of their reproduction. Okay, so I don't think, again, anything will surprise you here, but what's really come out of this exploration of these case histories for us so far is that mental health, mental capacity, is really running right through this group of women. Okay, so there's major issues around their capacity to exercise choice, to be in control of the intimate partner relationships they're in, and long-standing mental health issues, some going back into childhood. Obviously, domestic violence, relationship conflict, substance misuse, learning disability 40%, which is, again, is quite high. We've also found sexual assault and sex working, sadly. We don't know how much from file studies is disclosed, but again, you can see if you begin to put this picture together, this is a highly vulnerable population. So I think the empirical data does certainly support the motion that these mothers are vulnerable. We also looked for positive features in informal networks. We only found in 13% of the networks that we could actually identify a relative who could give support. So again, we thought that's an issue we want to probe further in relation to decision making and women's sense of control over their lives. Criminality featuring lots of very, very violent men with these women, and a number of them in prison, in and out of prison. We also wanted to look at mothers' own childhoods. It's not easy nowadays when you want to look at women's childhoods through case files, because I think lots of the court reports I've seen are focused on parental compliance. The old kind of psychosocial approach to understanding families seems to be a bit of a thing of the past. But what we managed to probe was that 87% of our sample have got children's social care involved in their childhood. And if we were to take just the UK cases, because we've got four migrant women here, that would be 100%. So 100%. Have had very difficult childhoods. 50% have had a care episode. We've got a number of young care leavers in this sample. Sexual assault in childhood. Actually, I've missed a point there. One of the things that's really interesting is this business of a parent abandoning a child or death of a parent, which has surprised us but has come out in the sample. Exposure to family violence. Obviously, again, that won't surprise you. And mental health in a parent. So incredibly difficult and damaged lives for these vulnerable women. What we've tried to do, I suppose, taking it a little bit further, and again, recognising the limitations of a sample of 30 mothers only, is to say, OK, one size doesn't fit all here. Actually, we've got some beneath those kind of global statistics, if you like, global picture, we've got some differentiation in respect of these women. Their particular pattern of vulnerabilities and their particular challenges that they present to services. So we group them. Again, I want to say this is quite limited because it's a pilot study, it's only 30 mothers. But we have a group who think learning disability is the overarching feature of these cases. And some of those mothers were very much engaged with children's services. But obviously they're probably just falling above now the eligibility criteria for adult services. So when they fall off adoption proceedings, maybe they'll have access to adoption support, possibly some good practice in some areas, but they're not likely to receive an adult services response. So though it might be that those women can be assisted to access healthcare, etc., during proceedings, certainly after proceedings, they're likely to find themselves fairly alone in the world. Group two, substance misuse. So here's the FDAC. Again, people who seem to have just huge problems with drugs. And we see in this group, interestingly in our study, periods where babies are at home, but sadly periods of relapse. But again, a slightly different pattern of service use, and a slightly different pattern of particular vulnerabilities. We also got a group of young care leavers, which I think, you know, tug at all our heartstrings, that these young, very, very young vulnerable care leavers, often partnered with other young vulnerable care leavers, are really, you know, quite a worrying population, particularly as we've taken cases that are very recent. So this isn't historic. This is kind of past all the leaving care legislation and the New Labour 2006 leaving care series. So we would have hoped possibly to be doing something better. Now, chronic group four, I think Claire and I feel are the biggest challenge for a prevention agenda. And we said, we've described these as mothers with where the overriding issue is chronic and complex mental health. And as all of you know who've been involved, who are involved every day in the court process, the most likely diagnosis here is personality disorder and a recommendation of 18 months therapy before you can parent. What are the chances of getting your 18 months therapy? Zero. Okay, and getting worse. So, I mean, I think they are a very challenging group in terms of their histories are very poor in terms of mental health backgrounds, but also the prognosis is poor because I actually think they fall into a therapeutic hole that we simply, as a country, don't really provide that service. Okay, so onto my last slide. I hope I'm within time. Failed by the system. Just an example of a care leader. So this is the second part of the motion. If we're going to support this motion, we need to evidence failures within the system. This is a bit of a busy slide, I'm afraid, reflecting my teaching background when students want a million amount of stuff on the slide. But you'll see I've highlighted in red here where this young care leaver has failed. So it's a 16-year-old. History of care episodes. Age 16, returns to live with her parents who can't cope with her. They make a number of referrals to the local authority. What does the local authority do? No further action. Close the case. We're not readmitting this person to care. We've run out of ideas. So there she is at 16. She's pregnant. She's in a bed and breakfast, and she's hanging out with offenders. Pregnancy is notified early by the leaving care team. Great. 16 weeks. There's a little window of hope there. But what happens is children's social care hold it in their electronic box and say this can come through at 26 to 28 weeks because we've got a queue of these mothers, so she's got to join the queue. And it's opened at that point for child protection assessment, child protection conference, and pre-birth assessment. So I guess at that point, possibly the following events don't surprise you, which is that what the local authority deemed during that short window between the pre-birth assessment and birth of the baby is that here's a young mother who is unable to maintain a tenancy, who is presenting rather too often for food parcels, okay? And I think, again, this might be familiar to you. So a pre-proceedings meeting is called, and the young girl comes along. She doesn't have legal representation, but a plan for a comment section 20 goes ahead anyway. And finally, the story goes on. Baby's removed at birth, care proceedings, etc. But what really struck me about this is there's no psychological assessment or therapeutic input around what is noted on the file, query attachment issues. Of course she's got attachment issues. She's ambivalent about the baby. Look at her own childhood. But there's no work done there. So there she is at 19. Both infants are placed for adoption because she's had another one by now. And she leaves the court with a damning parenting and psychological assessment. Okay, so that's my case in support of the motion.
I don't have any slides at all. First of all, I'd like to say I'm actually talking against this motion, and I'm talking against it because I don't think there is a system failure. I think there may be a lack of coordination, but not necessarily a system failure. So I work in Suffolk, and for the last 3 years, I've been working with a very small, select team who've been supporting these women. When I say a small, select team, I mean one health visitor, one midwife, and myself. And we've kind of done it on the back of a postage stamp. So team's probably a bit too exaggerated. Why did we start it? We started it because I got fed up of presenting my quarterly reports to my senior managers saying, we have a problem. Look at these statistics. They're not going away and they're increasing. So they said, well, then do something, Tina. So we did. We tried to do something. So I'll come on to what we've actually done in Suffolk, but first of all, I kind of want to address two questions to you. One of them is, what's the scale of the problem? And I think, quite rightly so, you've said already, there is no national or local data. There are small pockets where people have got an interest and have started to get some statistics together. But nationally, locally, we're not required to report on this. And also, why it's so difficult to meet the needs of these women. Because actually, we all know what the needs are. We all know what the outcomes of the psychological assessments say. So why is it so hard to meet that need? So coming on to the scale of the problem, whilst there's no national or local statistics required, we know from a study in Berkshire that there were 43 babies removed from 30 mothers who'd previously had 76 children removed. That's really scary. That's in a 1 year. Bringing it back to local issues where I am in Suffolk, we've done some work. We have three hospitals that cover Suffolk. One hospital has worked with us on this project. And we've had 34 babies removed in one financial year, 2011 to 2012. Of the 34 babies removed, 24 had previous siblings in care. And of those 24, four women were on their seventh and eighth child. So it's a problem. And it needs to be addressed. So why is it difficult to meet the needs of these women? Well, I think for me, I've learned a lot in engaging with the women that we've been able to make a difference to, in the fact that one day they're everybody's clients, they belong to everybody, and they've got a wealth of activity, and the next day they're nobody's. All the services are directed to them when they're pregnant and whilst we're trying to look at the assessments with the child, and after that, there's nothing. Children and people services are directed to work with the children. The court system's about the children. There's nothing about these women that make them a relevant caseload for anybody. I think for me, the key issue you mentioned was the psychological assessment. And they're assessed in a period of time where they're scared, the defensive, the frightened, they're about to lose their child, and we wonder why the assessment's always quite negative. And we've looked at reassessments, which actually are a lot more positive when they're not in that period of time where they're really fearful that they're about to lose their child. So I do think the current system can work for these women if we move it forward and we become flexible within the system. And that's the basis why I'm kind of speaking against, which has proved difficult. But I think first and foremost, we need to realise that these are a really hard to reach group of women. And actually, you're not going to be able to help everybody. So how do you measure success when you're working with human behaviour? And actually, we need to be really clear that there will be a group of women we're not going to be able to help. And we need to understand the willingness, but also the capacity to change, because they're two entirely different things. And we've learnt that through the work that we've been doing. We've got one mum. I'll probably phrase my wording a lot more polite than she worded it to me, but basically told me to whistle in the wind. She'd had or was on her ninth baby about to be removed. And she told me, don't be ridiculous. I'll join your group when I've had 10. My mum had 10. My grandma had 10. For me, she's in almost a too difficult to reach group. She's got a mindset. And we need to be real about the resources we do have. So what have we done in Suffolk with our existing resources? So on the back of the FAG packet, we had this wonderful idea and we worked with 15 women. We identified 15 women that we could make a difference with. Fantastic. By the time we got to them, within the 6 to 12 month, 12 week period, they were pregnant. 10 of them were pregnant. So timing is of the essence. And pivotal to this is the lack of contraception services. These women lead chaotic lifestyles. They don't turn up to an appointment on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. The DNA, and they get closed. So we have to find a way of kind of outreaching to them and bring them back in. So by the time we realised that contraception was a bit of a problem, we had to identify a few more women to work with. We've gone for the real directive approach. We're hand-holding and we're proactive. If we don't go and get them for the appointment, they're not going to get there. But the gain in going and getting them, in building that trusting relationship, is tenfold. Key benefits to these women? Well, we've spoken to them. And I think the most telling bit for me is one lady that we worked with, that 6 hours after delivering her baby, she walked out the hospital to pick a man up in the street to have sex with. That wasn't about sex. That was about a need to be needed. That was a human crying out. That kind of stuck. We've also worked really well, and the feedback that we've got is we've allowed these women to take control back of their own lives, just in piece bits. But actually, by doing that, they have a sense of belonging, just a tiny bit that they're not done to. They have a bit of control over their lives. And they come from chaotic backgrounds. You've seen the background history to these women, so I don't need to go back through that. So the impact of this work, whilst modest, we can report that we've had some early mixed results. Of the 7 women that we finally got to engage with, that we've not, are not pregnant, because we have the contraception services in place. One did drop out and become pregnant. 2 others also dropped out, but they were transient. They'd been through a number of local authorities, so they actually disappeared off the radar. We've had 2 that took up long-term acting contraception and have actually gone on to be sterilised. That's really quite shocking, and people don't know whether that's a positive or not, but actually they took control. So I think that's a real positive. And we're engaging with 2 women at the moment that's going really successful. They've had the reassessments. The psychological assessment, believe it or not, no longer says 18-month psychotherapy personality disorder. It actually states that with 3 months therapy, this woman's in a position to start to positively parent again. And she's now getting a nursery ready. Doesn't mean it'll work, and it doesn't mean if it fails, it's wrong. But actually, it means that we're trying. So in Suffolk, what have we done? We've worked with these 7 women, and we've made a savings of about £700,000. Actually, that's almost an irrelevance because it's the human cost. And we've managed to do it on the back of a postage stamp. That's why I'm against this motion. We are moving forward, so I am going to make a plea while I'm here, because I might as well, because apparently my colleagues tell me there's some wonderfully eminent people in the room. I'm hoping some of you have got some purse strings. We're actually in the process of setting up 3 supporter roles to outreach to these women in Suffolk. We've already got funding from Suffolk County Council for 1 post. We've got funding for another post from the Ormiston Trust. And we are moving forward. We have coordinated our services in Suffolk to recognise these women as a priority status. We've learnt from our looked after children, which we think we do positively discriminate against now. And we've done the same for these women. So they are fast-tracked into mental health services, drugs and alcohol services, treatments, therapies, etc. So we've taken the lax status and moved them forward. And on that bit, I'm going to end. But we do have a third, sorry, I just had to stop you, because a third role I don't have the funding for yet. So if any of you do know of anyone that wants to provide any funding, I'm more than willing to take your names and numbers. Thank you.
Right. Good evening, everybody. Up until March 2012, I was Director of Children's Services in Reading. So what I'm going to talk about relates to my experience working as a DCS in Reading. Why do I believe the system is failing women? I believe that even though you might be able to deliver within our current system a service that helps some of these vulnerable women either to parent effectively or to decide not to have babies in the future, the system does need a fundamental rethink if we are going to make effective provision for both the women and the children. Why do I believe that we need this fundamental rethink? Well, in Reading, we had a similar story to what you've heard so far. We found that we'd removed, in a certain period of time, we'd removed 106 children from 30 families. 106 children from 30 families. We looked at the mothers in detail. We found an equivalent finding that of these children, 30% were born during the care proceedings from a child that was previously in care proceedings. And the mothers, the average age was 26. The biggest reason for initiating care proceedings was substance misuse, with domestic abuse, learning disability, and mental health bringing up behind them. Now, why do I believe this was due to a system failure? We looked very carefully with our adult services colleagues at what sort of services the women had received. So to start off with, what sort of support had they received for those difficulties that I just described? We found that if you were a substance misusing mother, you did receive a service. It was fairly straightforward. You were substance misusing, you went into a substance misuse service, and actually, if you were referred within 5 months of the birth, many of those services were very effective at getting the parents off drugs or to have to be maintaining drugs safely by taking methadone. So actually, those services were quite effective, provided they have time. If they were referred at 2 months before pregnancy, they didn't have enough time to do that piece of work. However, we found that for mothers with mental health difficulties and mothers with learning difficulties, they didn't get services. They were often referred to adult services, and they were told they didn't meet the criteria. The parents with mental health difficulties didn't have a disorder that was classifiable under ICD-10 classification. The mothers with the learning difficulties didn't have an IQ that was below 70. However, in both cases, their mental health and their learning disability was sufficient to mean that they couldn't continue to parent a child. When we looked in detail at why did this happen in adult services, we found that actually the basic need as defined in policy is for adult services to be offered to anybody who is unable to fulfill a basic family function. That's the actual definition. But when you're organising your services, you don't organise them on that basis. You decide to put together parents who have put together adults who have mental health difficulties in one service, adults with learning difficulties in another service. And actually, if you don't fit either of those and you have a sort of different sort of difficulty, you tend to not get a service. So one of the fundamental difficulties is actually how we organise services, because the way we organise services actually determines the lens through which we look at families and offer them services. Second interesting thing about the way we organise services, what kind of assessments that we do on these mothers. Well, one of the extraordinary things we found is we were paying for assessments on all the mothers at a cost of about £4,000 per assessment. But what question did we ask when we asked for that assessment? We didn't say this is a vulnerable adult, we want to know what their needs are. We said this is an adult, we want to know whether they're going to be able to parent successfully in time for this baby. So we got lots of reports saying, no, this mother won't parent in time successfully for this baby, which didn't tell us what the parents needed, because actually that wasn't what we asked. Interestingly, overnight, we made a difference in our commissioning of assessments. We stopped just saying we want to know whether they can parent. We said, and we want to know what would help them parent successfully in the future. What was really interesting is it didn't cost us any more to ask that question. So with an immediate change. So we then looked at, well, just out of interest, what is all this costing us? Because obviously our adult services colleagues were saying, well, it's very difficult for us to take on more adults, because we've got this certain amount of resource and we have these tight criteria to help us manage the amount of resource that we've got. So we looked at the cost of provision being made for these mothers across the services. So we costed everything. We costed the referral to social care, the assessment in social care, both initial and core. We costed the cost of social workers' time in strategy meetings. We costed the amount of support the social worker provided to the foster carer and to the birth family. We costed the amount of cost the court fees were, the assessments, and also the time of the infant in foster care. That was the biggest cost. So per infant, the costs were £66,000 for every infant that was in an internal foster placement and £102,000 for every infant that was in an external foster placement, because independent foster placements are much more expensive. This means the average costs for each mother, and the average number of children they had removed was three. So each mother had three children removed. The average cost for each mother ranged from £200,000 if their babies were in internal foster placements and £300,000 if their babies were in external foster placement. We had one mother who had eight children removed, and the cost for her babies would have been between 0.5 million and 0.8 of a million pounds. So we said, is this very cost effective for social care to continue to operate in this way? And wouldn't it be more effective if we operated rather differently? So I'm now going to go on to why I think the system is fundamentally flawed. Because one of the discussions we had was, what was our objective? Now, our objective in children's services was to keep the children safe. That was the paramount objective that we were focusing on. We didn't really have an objective for the mother. Now, there were two problems with that. One is that at a certain age, you stop being a child and you start being a mother. And once you start being a mother, you're somehow responsible for what happened to you, and you're not classified with the same vulnerability as if you're a child. And that cutoff point seems incredibly arbitrary if you're a vulnerable adult. The second issue is the fact that we had the wrong goal. We should have actually had a goal of, yes, we want to keep the baby safe. That's fundamental. But actually, we also want more women to be enabled to change their lifestyle so that we remove fewer babies at birth. So when we actually refocused ourselves around that goal and said, if as a children and adult services working together, we focused on the goal of more women being able to change their lifestyle and ability to parent, either to decide they didn't want to parent or to be able to parent successfully, we will then remove fewer babies at birth, and we should have a goal that we don't have to remove fewer babies at birth, not because they would still then be unsafe, but because we know that either they wouldn't be born or because they would be born and the parent would be able to support them effectively. So I believe services are fundamentally flawed for two reasons. One is they fail to see children and adults in a holistic way and understand how they're joined up. They fail to see the connection between the vast amounts of funding that are spent on children's social care and the minimal amount of funding if you're a vulnerable adult and you don't actually meet the core criteria. And there are also a fundamental issue with the culture that at a certain point we stop seeing adults as children, when actually a lot of these vulnerable adults are really still children in the way that they think, in the way that they process, in the way that they look after their lives. So that is why I'm arguing that the system is fundamentally flawed.
I hate speaking without a lectern. I feel all my special props are ruined. When I was first informed about the motion, before you can say 26-week timescale, immediately the slots for speaking for the motion were taken. And I kind of thought, rats, because I'm the local authority lawyer, and many of you will think I am the face of the system. And those of you who know me personally will know that I find the idea of being an establishment figure rather amusing. But nonetheless, for those of you in the room, I'm sure I am the face of the local authority. And so I was quite relieved to receive this advice from the secretary to the FJC. She said, all of you may agree with the motion, albeit perhaps for slightly different reasons. However, speaking against the motion does not imply uncritical support for the status quo. And this came as a relief because I thought, were I to appear to be that uncritical supporter, it would be a bit like Paul Dacre stumbling into the AGM of Hacked Off. And I have every sympathy with those of you who do get hacked off with what appears to be a very complicated system that doesn't always know how to assist vulnerable adults. And I should say right at the start that I do agree, I think it's a no-brainer, that women who have children year after year trying to gain some form of solace from their repeat pregnancies are clearly vulnerable. And it seems to me self-evident that those women ought to be entitled to some form of adult services which represent their vulnerability. The problem, I think, is that do we have a system which is going to address this? And the answer, I think, is we don't have a single system. What we have is a series of systems. We have adult services, we have the NHS, we have children's services. And for years and years and years, one of the things that's curious to me about this agenda is everybody has recognised that that is a problem that needs cracking, but nobody seems able to crack it. And successive governments have indicated that this time they want to solve that problem. But the problem is everyone seems to do it from an ideological perspective. So we set up children's trusts, and the idea there was to have pooled budgets, a plan that adult, NHS and so forth will work together again. And the first thing the coalition did when it came into power was it ended the Department of Children, Families and Schools, and it became the Department of Education. And this was very visibly represented by the dismantling of the rainbow. I don't know if anybody of you noticed that. The rainbow became pixelated, that had previously been the logo for the Department of Family, Schools and Children. It's really important for the system to be joined up. So I want to issue now a note of caution about GP commissioning, because some of you will notice that changes are coming to the NHS, and it's a very dramatic change. And in future, instead of having children's boards that are supposed to join up some of these services, we will have health and wellbeing boards. And actually, the commissioning of mental health services, and I think you've heard a lot of very persuasive information about the need for proper mental health services, are going to fall to GPs. And I would hazard a guess that this is not the most sexy agenda for them. And some GP commissioners may think hip replacements is an easier issue to solve than what's going to be necessary to meet the needs of these women. And this is where I come to the graph of doom, because I can't avoid talking about the vulgar subject of money. So apologies for that. Some of you will have this in your packs, I hope. You will see in the graph of doom that for local authorities, if we continue to spend as we are, by 2018-19, literally in my local authority, there will be no money left to do anything other than children and adult social care. So the challenge for the system is if change is needed, it must be done within existing resources, which means those resources need to be targeted. Because when you hear about very good schemes like Tina's scheme, what Tina can't do is solve every problem. And so it's really, really essential that we recognise that the system isn't to blame for all human failings. And of course, would you actually want a system where all human failings were the business of the system? I suspect that you wouldn't, because the danger is that if we have that kind of culture, it becomes very, very interventionist and rather scary. And as I heard a psychologist say recently, without someone who wants to be treated, there is no patient. And here I find myself in the rather ironic position of defending the right of the mother to tell the social worker to. Now, I don't want to make the news in the podcast by using the word I would like to, but were they to tell the social worker to go away, it seems to me they have every right to do so. So in an age of finite resources, and given the stakes for the child, it's really vital to work out what is achievable and hone in on it. And this isn't an easy thing to achieve. And I'm wary of professionals who work in good faith, like those in Tina's team, being branded failures because they can't wave a magic wand. And actually, the reality can be very stark. I sometimes do something I suspect not many eminent people in this room do, which is I attend meetings before action. And I remember a meeting before action that I went to last year involving the mother of 8 children. I'm slightly going to conflate the facts to protect her identity. And what was tragic about this was that it was not that this mother had been offered no help. She had been offered help from every agency you can imagine. But she was so damaged as a result of her parenting that she could not trust anyone who came from any kind of public agency. And as we sat in the meeting offering her this and offering her that, I realised that the fundamental problem was on the table in front of us. And this was the clear plastic bottle that she was drinking from, swigging from, that seemed to produce the effect of her slurring her words. And I will say no more than that. And eventually, when we were in proceedings and when the liver test results came back, even then, she was not prepared to accept any offer of help to deal with what was plain as day, alcoholism that had been in her family for years and years and years. But when we looked at her childhood, we didn't have to look very hard to understand why she felt like that. And I just want to mention something about the timescales of the child, because what is essential here is that the system targets its resources to avoid children repeating generational cycles of abuse. That is essential, because what we know is that where adults are very, very damaged, some of them, it's too late for the child and they are not going to be successfully offered help. And there's a very interesting, some of you will know it, the Loughborough research from 2010 that really looked at the need for changes to be made within the first 6 months of the child's life. And unless that happened, it really was too late. Well, what this tells me is that what the system is not good at is addressing pre-proceedings the needs of the adult. And I strongly believe that that is something that has to absolutely fundamentally change. Once we get to the beginning of that 26-week timescale, it is very unlikely we're going to be able to turn really fundamental problems around unless it's at the cost of the child. So the system really needs to be able to distinguish between those parents who can and want to be helped and those who are unresponsive and dangerous. And that's quite a task, isn't it? Let's take an example. Let's think about a young woman by her early 20s. She's a mother of four by different fathers. She's experienced an absent father who is a sex offender, a neglectful and abusive mother, and another relative who was lured into a paedophile ring in one of the biggest children's home scandals of the late 20th century. And when the state intervened to protect her, it was too late and it was ineffective. Now, what should the system do when confronted with someone with that history? Well, they should be sympathetic. They should recognise that she's going to need assistance. They need to recognise that this parent will need help in their own right. And no doubt the system should recognise that that help might not be effective on fast timescales. So what should we do? Should we offer her a package of support? Should we offer her some respite care, maybe a childminding service, maybe some therapy for her? What should we call that mother? Should we call her Tracy? Tracy's experience with social services as a girl made her terrified of social workers, and it also made her attuned to the sorts of buzzwords and language that the system likes to hear and feel reassured when it does. In fact, Tracy might be so cooperative that we could ask her to participate in solution-focused practice. And we might even film it in an hour-long interview as part of a course in new social work methods aimed at encouraging parents to cooperate with the authorities. And who couldn't sympathise with Tracy when she says, "I don't like having people interfere. I know that the social worker is there for a job, and I know that they are there for a purpose. And at the end of all this, I hope they will back off and leave me alone because I am a caring mother." And we'll have lots of monitoring, and we'll have lots of different professional agencies being involved with the family, including such lauded organisations as Great Ormond Street Hospital. And what happened to Tracy's fourth baby? Well, her baby, baby Peter, died months after months of abuse under the noses of adult housing, health and children's services. And it was a seminal moment in child protection in the 21st century, and it's one that we shouldn't forget. So I want to issue a note of caution, because while I am very sympathetic to the sentiments behind the motion and I would support much of it, I think it would be a disaster if the voice of the child were to be lost because of sympathy with the evident pain of the parents. Creating a vicious generational cycle of neglect and abuse will never be a way to solve this problem. The challenge for our society is that prevention is always better than cure. And the one thing this audience can agree on is that where the system works best, treatment and cure become one and the same. Treatment of an adult represents prevention for the child. But in the few cases where treatment cannot succeed, the system must save the child. And this way, there is hope born from tragedy. And that, ladies and gentlemen, should never be regarded as failure.
Speakers, for your wonderful presentations. How are we working this, Tessa? Is it a roving microphone? Right. So would the first contributor like to put up a hand and gain the microphone? If you'd kindly say what sort of work you do.
Well, I have two hats. One is as a lead legal advisor for the Family Proceedings Court in Berkshire, and the other is as a judge in the Social Entitlement Chamber. So I see lots of very damaged individuals, people with mental health problems, learning difficulties, and who have been involved in care proceedings. And the thing that struck me, which all of the speakers said about, and which is something that I see day in, day out in both jobs, is that it seems that once care proceedings have come to an end, the treatment and the focus on the mother also comes to an end. And I've noticed it even when you've got a parent who is in care proceedings for one child and is pregnant with another child, the court almost inevitably makes a care order. And despite the fact that there have been recommendations in various reports for mother to have the psychological treatment and that within 18 months, by that time, she should be capable of parenting, that comes to an end. All of those recommendations have ceased. And even when we know she's pregnant, we're still not doing anything because until that child is born, proceedings won't be issued. And it seems that we're really failing in that respect because we've already got an example of a child that will be born, a parent who needs so much time, and that time, even now, goodness knows what it will be like in the when we hit 26 weeks, but there isn't sufficient time to be able to treat that mother. So again, another child is going to be lost into the system. And a thing I see when I'm sitting as a judge is that I've dealt with hundreds of cases just in this last year, and I'd say 75% of them, mental health problems, learning difficulties, perhaps receiving counselling or other kind of medical treatment. But as far as social services support is concerned, I can count on my hand the number of people who've actually received that support who aren't parents. If they have children, then there's a high level of support. If they don't have children, then they seem to be lost to the system.
There's a hand over there, Tessa.
I'd just respond to that, because interestingly, when I was in Reading, it was the Berkshire courts that were dealing with it. We did find that effectively the mothers were abandoned after the child was removed, except for some support from the post-adoption services, which really focused on the bereavement issues around the loss of the baby, rather than the problems they had in their lives. So exactly that experience, that actually we were focusing on this person as a parent who'd lost a child, but not as an individual who needed to get a better life, if you know what I mean. So we actually felt another number of mothers need something like a life coach who would actually befriend them, be very assertive in their outreach. And actually what we ended up doing in Reading as an immediate response was to employ a very assertive contraceptive outreach nurse who worked with the mothers immediately after birth and was willing to be persistent in persuading them to take long-acting reversible contraceptives so they could have time to focus on how they might turn their lives around.
I'm a psychiatrist, so I thought it might be useful to say something That's how I see borderline personality disorder. I mean, I agree completely that there is a falling between services when you come to dual diagnosis people or people with learning disability who have problems, and I'm sure there's work that can be done to improve a combined care. But with borderline personality disorder, I have found that there's a lot of prejudice. I know we're all prejudiced, but there seems to be a lot of prejudice from social services. And once that diagnosis is there, it tends to stick. And what we know about the problem is that younger people are often diagnosed with this problem, and then maybe their diagnosis changes. I know particularly I can think of one girl who had a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, who had three children by different parents, fathers, and after each pregnancy, she was particularly ill, and she went off the rails, and the child was taken away. And one case of court order meant that she served her sentence in hospital. So she was obviously separated from her child. And we suddenly realized that what we're seeing was a hypomanic episode, and what she actually had was bipolar disorder. When we treated that effectively, we actually changed this lady's behavior on a long-term basis, and she was perfectly able to look, and in fact, she was a very good mother. We had an enormous difficulty in persuading social services to look again at this problem. In fact, it only happened that she got her three children back when the father who had all three, against a lot of evidence that he wasn't performing well, actually discovered through other information that he was an appalling father, and they came back to her. But this, what I think we need to understand about borderline personality disorder is there is an overlap with bipolar illness. Quite a few, 15% of people have dual diagnosis of the two. There's a group that move from one to another. And anyway, if their diagnosis is borderline, the chances are they get better as they mature, that it's not a hopeless situation, that they do gain maturity and they can do things later on that they couldn't do before. And I think if that attitude were prevalent, we'd probably provide more comfort and support to these women to help them look forward to coping better.
Anybody want to comment on that?
I've spent the past 2 years looking at pre-proceedings practice in local authorities. And I think one of the things that's really struck me is the lack of mental health assessment early when children are first subject to child protection plans. It seems to me an unintended consequence of the public law outline is that specialist assessment work is done very late when care proceedings are sort of in view, or certainly within the local authorities that I've been working with. And I think there's often a sort of, it feels like local authorities are not taking proactive action at a timely point to say, we can see there's something wrong here, we don't know what it is, let's see if we can get an assessment. But if you leave everything until the absolute last minute when you're in care proceedings, it's almost like the assessment's done not to inform a treatment plan or a family support child protection plan, but to ratify a decision that's already been made to prove a case. And then, as you say, it does tend to stick. I mean, one of the things that Claire and I have been, I suppose, quite concerned about in our work with local authorities is that there is a bit of a fait accompli, and that might be about also about being economic with time. Here's one that's going to be relatively easy to progress through proceedings. It must be very easy anyway as a social worker to get completely overwhelmed by loads and loads of cases of neglect and to look at which ones can be fairly swiftly progress through care proceedings again. I don't know if I'm answering your question. I thought your comment was really interesting anyway, so I'll stop there.
Hi, I'd like to question this notion about hard to reach families. I've been in social work for 35 years, and for 9 of those years I managed a completely non-referred, cradle to the Zimmer frame family centre. And we were packed out with these families that social workers said couldn't be worked with. And I met one of those parents, and she sat me down one day, and she was continuing my education about social work. And she said a very interesting thing I think of every morning when I put my key in the door. She said, the thing is about you lot, social workers, is it's too little help for too long, followed by too much help too late.
Thank you. I'm an adult psychiatrist, works with families all through my career. I was interested in the last few comments because it made me start to think about what would be the sort of control group to the work that you're doing. And that's the mothers who get their second child back. And what is different about them? And at first I started to think, well, in the trickle of cases that I've had, part of what's different is that they have a very supportive social work team going for them. But then I started to realize that it's something more intrinsic about the mother that gets the social work team on her side. Going back to the comment about borderline personality disorder, the mothers who come to mind for me just off the top of my head who get their children back are the ones who were not free of mental health problems, but usually the diagnosis was more about disturbed personality traits, not an organized personality disorder. There was often a longer gap between the first and the second child in keeping with your study. But I think you've given us a sort of checklist now of points that we might be start to think about that might help us to distinguish, for Tina's team, is this someone who is likely to make that jump as opposed to somebody who actually, it's not the best choice of mother to put your resources into?
Yes, response to that.
Yes, you see, so the voice of the local authority is going to feel obliged to do a bit of defending here, so I apologise in advance. I don't disagree with anything that anybody said, but I notice you keep using the phrase local authority. Local authorities do not provide mental health services. That's not what we do. It's not our function. Local authorities would love to have an enormous budget in order that we could make quick and easy referrals for precisely the cases that you're describing. And one of the reasons that I think debates like this are so important is that actually it's vital that we keep that mental health service agenda alive. Because if you're talking about mothers who need 18 months worth of treatment, many mental health services now will only provide 6 months. And I'm going to give you a top tip now. My own authority, you will often see things in the final care plan where a recommendation has been made for a particular type of treatment. And the phrase that you might see is that children's services will actively support this referral. But you'll notice the word referral. That's because children's services can't provide the material to do the work. What we can do is try and persuade those that can to prioritise the referral. And so my top tip is before the ink is dry on the final order and the parent walks away feeling wounded and having to work with the bereavement that they will inevitably suffer if their child is permanently removed from them, do what you can to get that parent to make that referral so that they can take advantage of the sway that children's services may have with linked public agencies to provide that service. Because the problem is, I have every sympathy when people say, when the proceedings are over, things come to a rather abrupt halt. And it will not surprise you that mothers who've just had their children removed from them, they're not terribly sympathetic to children social workers saying, now what else can I do for you, Gladys? Can I help you with that referral? It's really important, I think, that advocates for the parents try and persuade their clients to take advantage of that at a time when it's still before the court. Because, of course, were other agencies then to refuse that referral or to refuse to give it the priority needed, there are, of course, one hesitates to mention the term, other means with which to challenge unreasonable decisions about the provision of services for the most vulnerable members of society.
Just a short comment on that. That means that we can't complete, or we shouldn't be completing matters in 26 weeks.
Hello. I don't have half as much experience as most of the people in this room. I've worked in social services for 6 years and I've just gone back to law school. But I'm studying the use of forced sterilization in Asia. I'm researching as part of a working group. And I was curious to find that the UK had, the International Development Agency had sidelined 166 million to support a program to support forced sterilization in India. And I was curious to see what a speaker from either side of the motion might say to the proposal of having optional sterilization as part of a care plan.
We actually had a big debate about this in Reading because we had, for a while, we had an organisation on our patch that was paying mothers £200 to undergo a sterilisation. I don't know whether people remember this. Yes, we decided very strongly that we didn't agree with that. However, we did agree that long-acting reversible contraception was a definite option and that this could be very beneficial to mothers, particularly as we'd found that 90% of the pregnancies were unplanned. Obviously consciously unplanned, maybe not unconsciously unplanned, but that most of the women who were not using contraception in any kind of organised way, and even if some of them said they were on the pill, they weren't taking it regularly, which is why they did get pregnant in an unplanned way. So what we decided to do was offer this, what we called assertive outreach, and we employed somebody who would be persistent and meet the mother anywhere in the local Costa Coffee, not insisting they came to a clinic, and made a relationship with them while they were in hospital, and then subsequently met them several times and tried to persuade them to access local services. This was before Reading had put together a more specific offer for the women. But that's, we felt it was completely unethical to suggest or propose sterilisation for the women, because who knows what they might not be able to do with their lives in the future.
Sorry.
I've got to come in on this one as well. Sorry. I think in Suffolk, what we've learned is actually we start talking about the contraception when they book in for that first maternity appointment for the baby that they're about to potentially lose. So by the time they've delivered, we've now worked with our key maternity hospitals that they will not be discharged without a contraception package if that's what they wish to do. It's not forced. It's about taking them on that journey right from that booking an appointment.
I just wanted to make a point. I've worked with Karen on this study. And what I'd say to your point is that within our study, there was one mother who'd had 6 children removed but did go on to successfully parent 2 others. Change of partner, maturity, services, what would have happened to her?
Hi, I'm a child psychiatrist. I was interested in the comment my adult colleague made about the people with personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, tend to become more competent as they get older, more mature. They're less prone to the effects of emotional arousal, which I've heard presented plausibly before. I wonder whether any mothers who've had a recommendation for therapy, which does speed up that process and allows them to reach that maturity earlier, have sued under the Human Rights Act their local health commissioner for not providing them with the right to right to produce a family.
Well, there's a legal question. Come on, I'm not a human rights lawyer. Any human rights lawyer like to take that on? All right.
Hi there. I'm another child psychiatrist, funnily enough. But as I understood it, there's no right to produce families. There's a right to a family life. and all of that is superseded by the right of the child and the welfare of the child being paramount. Related to the question, to the point about sterilization and contraception, I was actually wondering about a journey starting even earlier than that, about sex education in our schools, which I think is very patchy and inadequate. In fact, that many of these girls who are in care, who then go on to become this vulnerable group of young mothers, don't access education properly. I'd welcome your thoughts on that.
Well, I would agree. In fact, we did a major study looking at what was the difference between young women in Reading who had a rather active promiscuous sex life during their teens and the women who didn't or were more careful about organised contraception. And part of the difference was about their access to information about contraception. But a bigger difference was about the whole attitude to life. So what was uncovered was that the young women who tended to have a more active sex life without contraception had a much more external locus of control. They felt events just happened to them. It was fate. It was c'est la vie. They imbibed a lot more alcohol and didn't watch what alcohol they drank, whereas the young women who had a more kind of organized and less frantic sex life were careful about what they drink. They were very careful about taking contraception regularly. They had a future story about their lives which was not about becoming a mother or becoming an attractive young woman. It was about becoming something in society. And part of the challenge we found, and particularly now schools are increasingly independent, was that we lost our resources for our PHSE advisor, who'd done a fantastic piece of work with the schools. The schools felt their curriculum was increasingly crammed and the focus was much more on standards. So a lot of schools moved over to an approach of having like 3 days of sex education over the course of year nine, and that was then it. That was your lot. So really, and while the government leaves schools to get on with it and then measures them only by the results they get, schools are not going to prioritise this part of the curriculum, particularly as teachers don't feel incredibly confident about how to teach it. If schools were measured more on the number of teenage pregnancies that they come up with or the number of terminations that occur on their patch, I think we'd get a completely different result, but we get what we measure, really.
Hi, I'm a play therapist, and I work with lots of looked-after children and do assessments of children for courts, but also assessments of attachment between children and their parents. And I wanted to make 2 points, really. One was, it seems to me that there is insufficient assessment of the adults' attachment styles as part of the early assessments. Because if you know that you have an adult who is very avoidant, you need to then make great efforts to engage that adult. Or an adult who is very attention-seeking ambivalent, you're going to contain that adult. And I think that that's one piece of information that's very, very missing from a lot of the assessments, because then that really identifies need and about how you can put services in. The second point is in relation to contact. A lot of contact I go and observe, and I'm completely frustrated that contact supervisors sit in the corner of the room and just make notes and observe and don't actively intervene. And it seems to me that this is an opportunity that we're really missing, where we could actively work with parents in contact. And a colleague of mine that's present here tonight, we're thinking of piloting a project of actively intervening in contact by doing an assessment and training contact supervisors to actually work with parents within the contact sessions, because I just think they're so missed. You have 3 or 4 contact sessions a week and nothing is being done. And we could have an enormous amount of information for the courts within a relatively quick timescale. So I welcome your comments about that.
I'm really delighted to hear you say that, because we're about to start exactly what you suggested in Brighton and Hove during contact sessions. And we think some parents will find this extremely intrusive, a very precious time that they have with their children. But we agree with you that we think for a lot of parents it's really dead time, and it would be useful to use it as some kind of parenting program. So I welcome your comments.
Thank you. I'm an academic from Essex University in sociology, criminology. I'd just like to make a quick comment and then add a question. The quick comment is, I think we do need a robust and mature discussion about long-acting reversible contraception in Britain. I don't think it's something that's across many people's radar. I don't think many teenagers know about it. We have a very low uptake of that particular method, you know, compared to other countries. But my question is, do people on the panel think that the Capacity Act could help in this way in any shape or form, in terms of helping people to build capacity and putting structures in place to assist with the building of capacity?
Okay, I'll have a go on the limited knowledge that I have of the Mental Capacity Act, PAM. I think there's something more fundamental, really. I mean, I was interested before when the woman towards the back of the hall asked the question about sterilisation, because I think there's just a question about how these women are empowered to access healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the sort of fundamental starting point. So we probably need to start there, really, and to do some analysis of that. I mean, I'm sure that probably our colleagues at FDAC could probably illuminate, or and certainly in Suffolk and Reading. But I mean, there's a sort of fundamental point, isn't it, about access to healthcare, and then and access to choices, then about, as you call it, Pam, reproductive autonomy and decision making. I mean, there was a test case, wasn't there, in the High Court with Justice Bodie presiding over it, where the local authority did try to bring a case under capacity. I mean, from the very limited reading I've done around this, it seems that the courts are unwilling to set any precedent in that respect. Am I right, or have I got that completely wrong? So, I mean, I think perhaps that's kind of going down the wrong avenue, although we could consider it on a case-by-case basis. But I think there is just a fundamental thing about supporting women to have access to healthcare and looking at the relationships there within and what power they have within those to access contraception and, you know, general stuff around sexual health. Because what we know about these women is they are highly marginalised and outside of services unless a proactive approach is taken, like your outreach nurse. You know, there's a real need here for outreach work to actually proactively engage people and ensure that they have access to things that other people have.
Okay. I'd just like to ask a question. I'm a solicitor in private practice. Sorry, am I interrupting? Sorry. I'm a solicitor in private practice, and I was very struck by the way the motion is worded. It says women who have children removed to care. Well, we're actually talking, you know, none of them are immaculate conceptions, are they? or at least we don't think so. So there are fathers here as well, and I'm very struck by the focus only on the mothers, whereas, you know, you do have fathers, and sometimes you can actually engage with the fathers. And I'd be very interested to hear from the panel as to what's happening as far as fathers are concerned, because, you know, they have got to step up to the plate, and they need to be as encouraged as mothers in this particular environment.
In Suffolk, we had a wonderful project of just that, really, young parents, both for young fathers and young mothers. Unfortunately, the funding was withdrawn, and we were able to evidence that we made a difference, and it is key and it's vital and missing in this. We've purposefully concentrated on the women because that's where we've started with the project, but recognising that it is a gap that we are missing.
Hi, I'm a childcare solicitor only representing parents in care proceedings. One of the things that I wanted to hear about is that, do you think that there's the hunger to have a more holistic approach to things? Because I can't think off the top of my head of any client, any young mother who I've represented who did well in school, who went on to do A-levels, who went on to have those prospects. They were, like, as far as I'm aware, thinking off the top of my head, all my young mother clients who are on either their first child, but unfortunately, inevitably going on to probably having more children in the care system, they dropped out of school 14, 15, or sometimes, you know, I speak to an 18-year-old who left school at 12, and you think, how is that even possible? But they did. So where is the sort of the impetus for the education department linking up with child services, linking up with housing, linking up with mental health? I appreciate earlier on you said that local authority is not the term that one can apply to all resources available to everyone in that region, that area, but there must be, well, is there this hunger for a joined-up thinking approach? Because to me, it seems like that's the logical way forward, is we have to change this system because we are just having children going through, having children themselves who are there for care. What's going to break this cycle, and is there a hunger to do it?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, and it's a very, very helpful point to have raised. So, as Director of Children's Services, we knew that the biggest single way to reduce the number of teenage pregnancies was to improve the quality of your secondary education in particular, and that actually teenage pregnancies go down as academic achievement goes up. Very, very frustratingly, the leadership now, exactly as you said, the rainbow is pixelated. The leadership now is schools focus on standards, and somehow children's services are slightly peripheral and slightly awkward occasionally, and we don't get much leadership nationally around children's services in particular. And we particularly don't get leadership around preventive services for young people in need. So one of the, I think the biggest tragedies we've experienced is that we were making such a difference to young people who are identified as not in education, employment or training or otherwise NEET. Mm-hmm. And the curve has really turned downhill on that one, partly because of the loss of the education maintenance allowance, which was an absolutely fantastic way of keeping young people who didn't have very much money in college, but partly because of the complete devastation of careers advice services, which, you know, were the substitute for a good middle-class professional parent who supports their young person to think about the career, and those services have absolutely been decimated. So I totally agree with you, and we need a lot more leadership from the government, which supports those local authorities that still want to deliver an integrated children's system despite the pressure, which is actually splitting it up at the moment, I feel.
Just wanted to add to that, that I think I'm right in saying that the Children Act 2004, which gives public agencies a duty to promote good outcomes for children, does not apply to academies. Beggars belief, really, doesn't it?
I think that there was such a compelling presentation that we got immediately into questions and debate and discussion. But I just want to comment on the high quality of each of the four presentations. I thought they were really excellent, and the whole kind of level of discussion. This is a really incredibly difficult area, but I sense just from everybody on both sides and from the audience that there's a real desire to do better here. Our experience in the Family Drug and Alcohol Court is it's all about timeliness and about creating the right sort of connections. Mm-hmm. So one of the fundamental connections is finding the person, the mother, the father, at a moment where they really want things to be different in some way. And that won't be everybody who's in difficulty. And sometimes with these repetitive cycles, it's going to be sort of further down the line or whatever. It's very odd. We don't always know what it is that changes things. But there's something about finding that moment where people are really desperate for things to be different from how they have been. They're tired of what's happened already. And at that moment, to be able to introduce the sort of level of support and help that would be appropriate. And I don't think that that is easy to do on a case-by-case basis. I think we are lucky, actually, working with drug and alcohol problems. I think it is harder to get that kind of link with our adult mental health colleagues and get things lined up. We want something not in a few weeks' time or a few months' time, but we really want it tomorrow, and we really want something quite comprehensive and thoughtful going forward. We don't just want an assessment. And I think that can only be achieved by some kind of quite careful and thoughtful commissioning. I don't think it can be achieved just with all the goodwill and hard work of the advocates and the sense of the court standing by. And then the third element really is it's got to count for something. It's got to be, whether the choices that people make. You're giving people an opportunity to make a choice, as Tina was saying, to take control. But it's got to count. And that's where I think the court can come in. And it might not be the court in these proceedings. It might be the court in the next proceedings. And it might be that the time taken for the journey by the parent is so different from the time needed for the child that this child and this parent need to part company. That the child can only wait for 6, the most 9 months, and has to move on quickly. The parent might need 2 years, might need more. But it's still a worthwhile journey. And again, I think we have to commission this. We have to design something that will address this need, because I don't think on a kind of referral by referral basis we're going to get something. But yeah, it's bringing together that moment, that desire for a change with the opportunity for change, with some kind of sense of compulsion, not compulsory sterilization or compulsory anything, but some sense that whatever decision these people make will have consequences. It's not a nothing thing.
Could I just comment on that, because it really struck a chord with me. One of the most impressive things I've seen is the way that Kids Company Project in London works with young adolescents, quite a lot of who have very, very severe attachment difficulties. And one of the ways in which they work, which is very important, it's about how do you create the moment that Mike's talking about, the moment when the young person is willing to commit to some kind of change. And the way it gets created in that organisation is by an outreach worker who has some understanding. Often they are workers who previously were in gangs themselves, so they're very close to the young person as role models. But they may persist for 6 to 9 months just making contact with the young person. In fact, I met one of the mentors and one of the young people who previously was a male prostitute who'd been brought up by substance misusing parents, and nobody knew they were substance misusing. And he said for the first 6 months, this young black man just told him to F off. But he kept on contacting him, saying, I'm still here. And after 6 months, the young man said, well, you're effing persistent. And then began to engage with him. But he was willing to persist for 6 months in the face of being refused. And what happens is many of these young people and these young vulnerable mothers are the same, can't trust people because nobody's ever been trustworthy before. And it takes them a long time to believe that here might be somebody that's actually worth investing in, that they might not actually be hurt as a result of the connection. And that's why I think we have to think of services very differently, because most services say there's got to be some motivation for the adult to engage before we'll help, but actually we may need to put something in place before that.
Anybody else want to?
Just like to comment on that again in a sort of parallel study that Karen and I were involved in, where we were following social workers and doing some home visiting alongside social workers. And we were sort of really we were fed up of seeing in case files this won't engage, sort of echoing the point made at the back about this hard to reach. What we would position it as is lack of skills to engage amongst the workforce. And what we saw in these home visits we did was the difference between the worker, that one particular that stood out, that would have a conversation through a letterbox, and she would go back and have another conversation through the letterbox, compared to the worker that knocked on the door, there was no answer, and walked away and recorded on the file that, you know, there's nobody in, they're not engaging. And I think that's a real challenge for us, particularly in social care services.
I'm a trainee psychiatrist from Essex. While we're talking about, say, mental health problems and all these, and the attachment issues in particular, so I'm really curious to know how does the system work for the children in particularly who have been removed, because that's very important, because as Karen said about the history and background of these ladies, they had a chaotic lifestyle, and most of them were taken away from their parents when they were young. So what we don't want is in 116 children taken in 4 years' time, they're going to sort of multiply if nothing is being done for those children in particular who have been taken.
Wait a minute.
I'm so sorry. You go ahead, Natasha.
When I was preparing for this debate, I did look at that Loughborough study. And it's actually quite interesting on the question that you asked. So they looked at, I think, about 47 children, and what they discovered that by their third birthdays, over half the children who didn't have a recognised medical condition were displaying developmental problems or showing signs of significant behavioural difficulties, and particularly aggression and speech problems were prominent. And these were children that effectively, the study was saying, had not been removed from a neglectful environment early enough. And this is one of the difficulties with this debate, is that we must not lose sight of the time scale for the child. Because one of the things we need to remember is all the scientific evidence that's emerging now about brain functioning. We do know that if children are exposed to very neglectful or abusive experiences in the first 6-9 months of their life, it can actually affect the way their brain develops. Mm. It's as fundamental as that. And this is one of the very, very difficult balancing exercises that we need to perform, which is why I was saying in my response to the motion that I think it's so important to assist these adults prior to their being a child. It's absolutely key, and it's one of the reasons that the system needs to be more joined up than it is, because if you look at that graph of doom, as it's known in local authority circles that I produced, it is very difficult to persuade mental and adult services that they need to lower their thresholds for a new client group to access long-term services. But my own view is the spend-to-save argument is a pretty unanswerable argument, and it needs to be made forcibly. And I do hope that when we see health and wellbeing boards come live in April 2013, that we will see those arguments pursued rigorously.
Can I just comment there? Yep. I think one of the things that we should avoid is an either-or. We're either child-centred or we're looking after parents, because they're not mutually exclusive. And I think, as Mike said before, you may feel this child needs to be removed and placed for adoption, but that doesn't mean we throw the parent on the scrap heap. Yeah. So it's not an either-or. And I think we get into that if we're not careful with the child-centred discourse, that actually, you know, we save children, and in doing that, that means we reject parents and abandon parents and replicate what's happened to them in their own childhoods. So I think we should be careful of that and just remember that actually, if we're removing a child, if we're saying we're not leaving this child in this neglectful household, you know, beyond 12 months, whatever period is deemed appropriate, fine. Okay, so an argument in favour of the motion in supporting birth parents is not an argument against removing children, but it's an argument about meeting their own needs in their own right.
I'm a knackered district judge who's probably been doing this work for too long. I'm very concerned for these vulnerable women, but I'm more concerned for their unborn and often unconceived children. And at the end of a really tough week, I sometimes veer towards compulsory sterilization, but I don't really mean that. I really like the sound of the assertive contraceptive outreach nurse. I prefer an aggressive contraceptive outreach nurse. The problem is the clash of the timescales. And I just wish parents would not see the birth of a child as a motivation to start dealing with their problems. I wish they'd deal with their problems first and then think about getting pregnant. And so I would really go for this whole contraceptive argument, and we've got patches and we've got reversible injections. And I would almost go, I think I would go, for compulsory contraception. Mike has talked about FDAC, and what I like about FDAC is the use of the authority of the court in a collaborative attempt to accomplish change, because I think that's important. And what I like about FDAC is that some of our parents who fail understand why they failed and don't fight and don't have that five-day case which produced bitterness and resentment. And that leaves them in a better place next time they get pregnant. And we have got a few second-time mums now in FDAC who have come back to us and said, I understand why I failed last time. I'm in a better position this time. Can I try it again? And I just want to tell you one rather sad story which ties in for what Tina's just said. I have a friend who's a senior partner in a GP practice in a country district who about 8 years ago was very concerned about the level of teenage pregnancy in her area, and she wanted to set up a clinic to advise these kids in school. But she couldn't do it at her practice because they'd be seen coming in, and so they wouldn't come. So she had a discreet, unmarked mobile clinic which went to the secondary schools. And after 5 years, teenage pregnancy in that area was reduced to zero. And for 3 years, it was zero. So the government had withdrawn the funding because there's no evidence of need.
Hi, Cathy Ashley from Family Rights Group. It was a couple of points and then a question. So the first point is that about the hard to reach is that we've had a 50% increase in the number of calls to our advice line from birth families. It's more than we can deal with, and funding is being reduced, although it is continuing but being reduced. And I just wanted to, so it was just part of that hard to reach. Actually, we're getting a lot of birth parents trying to contact us, trying to get independent advice and support, and they're the very people who are being termed hard to reach on the other side. The second is in relation to pre-births, and we often find that it's very late in the day that there is any form of pre-birth conference, and actually it's not enough time for the parent to be able to demonstrate, or parent to be able to demonstrate that they can actually address the concerns that have been outlined. And I do think there is scope, and I'd really like to see some form of conference or some form of activity in terms of looking at what works effectively at that pre-birth stage, because I think there are some pockets of good practice, and obviously there is the question about the woman's rights in relation to the fetus and how much the state does intervene, but nevertheless it is a big window of opportunity that we are, I think, continually failing. The third is just in terms of domestic violence, and I know that Karen and Claire did further research in relation to actually not just younger mothers who were losing children into the care system, but also you were finding sequence of teenagers being also removed in relation, when, and that was very heavy levels of domestic violence in those households, and it's just been a phenomenal increase in terms of analysis of calls to our advice line, is domestic violence being present in so many of the cases that we're dealing with. And so I do think we need to think about mothers as well as fathers, but I do think that also we have to look at the question about
how are women able to turn around their lives and address some of those problems when at the same time they're dealing with phenomenal amounts of abuse within their life at that point. And lastly, just a question, because we've got real concerns about the impact of the 26 weeks and reduce of scrutiny of care plans, etc. And I just wondered whether the panel wanted to say anything, because I think our experience, which is counter to, in a sense, the discussion we've had here, which I think is incredibly helpful, is that increasingly adults are being referred to in terms of their relationship to their child, and that's their function, rather than being seen as that being worthy of support in their own right in relation to themselves, but also future children.
I think somebody last year, sitting not a million years away, a million miles away from me, said something about it's essential that 26 weeks doesn't become a straitjacket. And I would really like to endorse that. However, the reality is there are cases when 26 weeks is about 16 weeks too long. And there are cases like that. And there is no point in us denying that. And we do know from study after study that where it's an absolute disaster is if a child has waited, I think the average for care proceedings at the moment is over a year, for an outcome that was pretty much inevitable from week one. And not every inevitable outcome represents a failing of the system. I think it's really, really important to recognise that. There are some, I'm going to use the phrase, hard to reach families, but there are actually some very obstinate families who refuse help, don't see the need to change, and won't change. And one can be very sympathetic as to why they are in that position, but the system has chosen to elevate the rights of the child, and therefore the system can't wait forever for those families. There are, flip side of that, families where it's really important that we don't have a 26-week straitjacket. And I can think of some very imaginative cases I've done in my own career where the social worker worked incredibly hard to bring the parent alongside, and it really did not feel safe or right to withdraw the judicial eye on that procedure until the parent was really able to parent the child safely. And those were cases where it would have been a disaster had it been over in 26 weeks. But as I understand the proposals for the new legislation, those are precisely the sorts of case where we would crave some judicial indulgence to move away from the target.
I just wanted to make a comment about the domestic violence and the point made earlier that we were focusing on mothers. We could have had a separate debate tonight about the way we deal with domestic violence in the system. And certainly in my authority, one of the key issues we felt there was that there was a failure to have the right objective around domestic violence, i.e. the objective would be that not only was the child safe and the mother, usually the mother, free of abuse, but that the perpetrator also wouldn't be violent in the future. And what we found was there was a massive big hole in services for men that they felt it was acceptable to access. And in fact, we've experimented with a wide range of things, but actually some of the best services are not run in the UK, they're run in the States, where services are run by men for men to help them look at how to manage their emotions, to speak about their emotions, to manage the emotions of others. They're very, very effective in improving the quality of relationships between men and women. So I think one of our challenges is to see perpetrators of domestic violence as people needing services. And in children's services, unfortunately, we try and wean the woman, usually the woman, away from the man. And if we successfully do that, the man goes off, gets no more service, but probably finds another partner fairly soon and repeats the cycle.
Yeah, and just on another no-brainer, Cathy, to pick up on your point, pre-birth assessment. I mean, why do we wait till 26, 28 weeks? We know all the research says pregnancy is a window of opportunity. But for some reason, Claire and I found local authorities quite resistant to that. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, working closely with colleagues in Coventry, where they have started pre-birth work much earlier, they've got some very good diversion rates. They're able to marshal kin and draw on the support networks beforehand. And also, if they then do go into court, actually, they've had longer to get evidence. So it seems to me that actually this is win-win all round. But local authorities are hugely resistant
because obviously they've got to ration resources, but waiting until the fetus is viable is a kind of classic child-centred perspective that's not holistic, and that is missing a real sort of time in which you might be able to affect change. It could be one of Mike's turning points, window of opportunity.
Yes, I'm a district judge and also a member of the Family Justice Council, and we're looking at these sort of revolving door cases, certainly from the mother's point of view, where they're repeatedly coming back to court, and we're talking about the interventions being too late, and we're very familiar with reports in drug and alcohol, in also in borderline personality disorder, and in domestic violence that say the time scale is 18 months, is 2 years, and the child's time scale is too short. And it seems to me that what we're missing is what might be called a post-proceedings protocol, a way of gathering the assessments and the information that crystallised during the proceedings, and then finding a way of formally handing over the case to adult services. The children's services come out at that point, and that, to me, seems the opportunity that's missed. We've got the information. We've almost got a definition of what this vulnerable group might look like, how you find who is in this vulnerable group, and to have the special category, a formal handover, release of those reports that are appropriate, or at least the opportunity to release them during the proceedings, and then a proper handover to adult services at that time. It would be more difficult for them to reject the case if they had the information that's available to the court at that time.
I'd definitely like to come in on that, because that's just what we've been trying to set up on a very small scale within Suffolk, and that's how we've affected the change, because we have in effect put in a team around the parent approach, a kind of an exit plan to that pregnancy of what needs to change, what needs to happen next, and who can do that. And we're now in the process of firming that up, both with CAFCAS, Children and Young People's Services, and the integrated teams, to just do exactly what you've said, and it makes a key difference.
The lady in front here.
Hello, Penny Williams, magistrate on Family Courts Committee, Magistrates Association, also heavily involved in domestic violence, and it's that I want to go back to. I mean, there is a shortfall in services for men. If you come through the criminal courts, then you can get on to IDAP. If it's private law, then CAFCAS can recommend as a contact activity going on to an equivalent IDAP program. Certainly in Hertfordshire, it's a question of doing it through the criminal IDAP program. In Hertfordshire as well, we're using something called Caring Dads, which I think is in, it came from London, originally from America, but that is privately funded. It's funded, it's not funded through local services, and I think that isn't... we're hoping locally it might actually then be taken up by CAFCAS as an alternative to IDAP. And I think that's something be really helpful if CAFCAS took on board. And I'm not sure whether this is something as well that can be done through the public law. It's there through the private law route, but I don't know if it's there through the public law route.
Yeah, anyone want to speak to that?
I really want to echo that. When my own authority looked at commissioning services around domestic violence recently, and that's an ongoing process, I had a light bulb moment where I realised that actually we did have a number of treatment programmes for men who were abusive, but you had to wait till you had a child to get on them or be an offender. And it did strike me that this was a bit of a problem if you were aiming at prevention.
Thank you. I'm almost definitely the least educated person here, but I am a graduate of Contact Centres, 15 official inquiries, 4 ombudsman's investigations, 2 parliamentary, who have findings in my favour against local services who facilitate and promote false allegations of domestic violence based purely on grounds of gender. The lady solicitor earlier asked about men being part of the solution, and the response from the panel was that they were focusing purely on the mothers, so be it. While there is the deep desire, institutional, within so many services, to only see fathers, even if they are primary carers for a decade, and the mother is bipolar, to only focus on the allegations against the father, denying all services to a father who has concerns, then the situation is only going to be perpetuated. This applies to the middle class. It doesn't just apply to the people who come out of care. It's behind nice, pleasant suburban doors. And it is a problem that needs to be addressed. It is the elephant in the room all too often in family courts and private law proceedings. And I hope that this question is suitably looked at by some agencies and authorities. Thank you.
I'm certainly not sure we said it's only women. I'd probably come back on that. It is recognised, exactly what you're saying. I can't argue or come back at you on that one, but we haven't said this is just purely women. But at the moment, with the project that I'm doing, we're only able to look at that part of it.
Mike, sure, again, I'm going to take a risk of sort of suddenly sharing some sort of thinking out loud. I mean, I wonder if one approach really is that we really need to profile this group of people that we're interested in as well as we possibly can. And then we need to imagine where they were 5 years ago. And whether that would help us identify a recognizable group of people. I mean, one suggestion a few minutes ago was they might be the very young woman that we took into care 10 years ago. And 5 years ago, they were still in local authority care, and the local authority was, you know, being a parent and had an opportunity to intervene. I mean, I'm actually very impressed. I'm involved in another project to do with sexual exploitation of children, and I'm very impressed by some of the police forces around the country and the kind of proactive approach that they're taking. And they're saying, we don't wait for someone to be actually sexually exploited. We identify a group of people who are highly at risk, and we intervene in that group. And there's a certain amount of sort of pragmatism and self-interest in that once they have been sexually exploited, they fall off a kind of cliff. It's a bit like the graph of doom or whatever, but they fall off a cliff in terms of just how damaged they are, the limitations in terms of being able to engage, the extent of resources that are necessary. And actually, I think that, you know, we could all learn quite a lot from the police here. I'm saying this, I'm just kind of surprising, but I think they are a lot more strategically driven in some areas. And there's a real drive at the moment about domestic violence, and it's again the same thing, the view that domestic violence is fueling a lot of other difficulties within families. It leads to the lack of supervision of young people because families are at war with themselves and so on and so forth. And that by intervening effectively with domestic violence that you can save an awful lot. So I think there are some models like that. You know, find these families 5 years ago. Intervene then. You'll obviously have to intervene with more people. They'll be at risk rather than actually in our category. But there might be a lot more options.
My name's Margot Coleman. Apart from being slightly less knackered than Nick Crichton, I also work in the Family Proceedings Court, but I also spend an awful lot of time in the youth court. And just picking up on that last point, you say that you're looking for the families. You really don't need to look very hard, because the families whose young children are appearing in the youth court today, those young children are the problem parents in not as much as 5 years' time. And I can never, ever understand why children and families and youth offending teams don't seem to share information more and get to work with those young people before their parents and heap the havoc that they heap on young children. It seems to me that it's not going to be expensive, for children and families to be able to pick up and feed in to those problem families. The police know who all the problem families are. It's all the antisocial behaviour that's out on the streets. And it's getting back to the points that were made earlier about joined up thinking. The information is all sitting in a number of different filing cabinets, and none of those filing cabinets seem to talk to one another. And I would have thought that in an age of computer technology where local authorities have all got the ability to have shared locations for their files, it shouldn't be very difficult to try and pick up on some of these people and save them.
I'd echo some of that, but I actually think it goes right back to early years as well.
I recognise that too, but I have to say in the defence of local authorities, I heard a presentation from two people from Finland a couple of weeks ago about the Finnish approach to helping vulnerable young people, and they've set themselves a target of every young person to be able to be got into education by the age of 25. So they track down the young people who are potentially going to fall out of the system, and they provide them with very intensive services. So their ambition is that there will be no workless young people at 25, because they'll have done everything to get them the right educational qualifications that they need. They've worked out that the cost of a young person who doesn't get work to their society is 1.5 million euros over their lifetime, if you take into account all the things that they might need in terms of unemployment benefit, and their children might need support, etc., etc. So, you know, in a sense, as a society, we need to grasp the nettle and say this is our ambition too. It isn't acceptable to have young people not going through our education system. We will have this goal, and we will resource it, because if we resource it in the short term, it actually will deliver for us as a society in the longer term. So, it's, you know, local authorities are working with a context where each year 7% of their budget is being taken away. And, you know, and they're also being told to take more and more children into care. So actually, that means that, what did you call this, the cliff of doom? The graph of doom is heading towards us, and actually there are some potential long-term invest-to-save commitments we could make as a society that would make the difference.
Yes, I've also enormously enjoyed the debate. I'm Judith Harwin from Brunel University, and I'm doing the evaluation of the Family Drug and Alcohol Court. I'd like to make some sort of general points. I think the debate's been very eloquent, but it does seem to me that trying to think through my own position, I think it seems to me a kind of no-brainer that something has to be done on this. And that the first thing that needs to be done is that we need to know the size and the scale of the problem. We're talking about small pockets, and already it's very clear that there are huge financial implications as well as human costs as well. So it seems to me that's the first thing we've got to do, get a much better informed picture of exactly how extensive this problem is and what its impacts are. That's number one. Number two, I think that in terms of the joined-up thinking, we need to know the joined-up costs as well in the short and the longer term. We've touched on offending, but we haven't put it all together. And I think there does need to be a holistic view of precisely how this is affecting society at large. Thirdly, I think we've been a bit economical with the truth regarding the effectiveness of the care system. It seems to me that we can't be complacent about its outcomes at any point, and I don't think I need to really underline that point any further. From the resource point of view, we know full well that there aren't enough foster carers, there aren't enough adopters. The kinds of debates that are going on at the moment have been said so many times over from different political parties, and we're still stuck. And we know that particularly in relation to substance misusing families, there is reluctance among some of the adoptives, prospective adopters, to take these children because they're concerned about the possibility of long-term problems that aren't there at birth. They can't be detected. So for all these reasons, to me, it really is a no-brainer. We have to do something. We have to find a way of best practice of engaging with these families, and everything that everybody said about the need for a continuum of services from children's centres through to, well, all the other services that have been mentioned is absolutely right.
So I'm concerned about some of these arguments that suggest that there's only a very short window of opportunity to turn families around. And I know that's a very powerful argument at the moment, and Harriet Ward's research is first rate in tracking families. But there is other, I think, more hopeful research that from FDAC itself, which certainly found that these families where repeat removals were very, very common, were able to start a new lifestyle. Now, we are only doing our second stage evaluation at the moment. The first stage was very encouraging. But I think that we're in a pendulum shift at the moment. I can't say that with any kind of grounds, but I feel the rhetoric is removal, 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 without insufficient thinking of the consequences. So I'm concerned about the 26 weeks, partly because I think it's also going to be cost-driven. I think we have to be very honest about these things. And also, I think that these families are very vulnerable at a time of economic huge uncertainties. So I think it's a huge agenda. I think it's a very important one. I've been fascinated by the debates, particularly around sterilization, but I think I know where my own mind is made up.
And no less, thank the audience who have brought such varied and valuable contributions. So thank you all very much.